You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. What's going on today?
What's going on today? I don't know. I forgot.
I'm really nervous
and shaky. Today we're going to be talking about anxiety on the show. And it's really exciting because we had a wonderful, wonderful therapist who worked for us a few years ago, and he, Jerry Cotter. Yeah, he was amazing. And he had been in the field a very long time, and he said, what I am seeing with all these young men who are addicted to opiates is incredible anxiety. And they were having trouble. What would happen is they'd be anxious. They would find the solution by drinking or drugging or something, and they would meet girls, and then they couldn't manage to do it sober because they thought it was something about something magical about doing drugs that they made them looser and easier to talk to and friendlier and smarter, and then they couldn't quit, and then that made them more anxious, and it became this cycle. And so he kept saying how these boys are all incredibly anxious, all the opiate addicts we worked with. So anxiety is one of those underlying things that if you can treat early and you can treat well may prevent someone from becoming an addict. And when you have someone who comes into your program and they have an anxiety disorder and an addiction, you have to treat them both at the same time. Because to quote you, what did you just say about, you were saying that people in early recovery are the most anxious people.
And early recovery and post-acute withdrawal are the most anxiety-producing things, and they have absolutely no coping skills, so it magnifies itself.
So in the quest for looking at these underlying issues, we found the book that I think made it that really, really dealt with somebody who had anxiety from a very early age, and his descriptions really get you in there, so you really understand, you know, instead of just, oh, just don't worry about it, you could see and feel what it was like to be inside of that.
That's Dan Smith, right? Smith.
Yeah, and we're gonna get to him.
He's the author of Monkey Mind.
Yes, Monkey Mind. But I mean, anxiety affects lots and lots of people in our country. About 40 million people. That's more than substance abuse.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So you think about it. People say hi. When they answer questions, you say, hi, are you anxious? And people say yes. So a lot of people are anxious. And there's this incredible tight relationship between anxiety and addiction.
Yeah.
This is anecdotal, but statistics also support that.
Well, then, when it's my experience is like yours. When people come to into our program, I always ask, and that's what we do is ask. But so many people, if they hadn't been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, they say, "I'm a very anxious person." But a lot of them have been, and of course it's, you know, alcohol, opiates. I don't know if I would take cocaine if I had an anxiety disorder, but a lot of the drugs.
A lot of things are helping people try to figure these things out.
But it's a stopgap measure, and it's not going to work long, and it's going to increase your anxiety. So there's got to be other ways to deal with it. We got a couple people here today on the show that are going to help us understand anxiety better.
Yeah, we have Daniel Smith, the author of Monkey Mind, a memoir of anxiety, and he's here with us. He began his career as a writer, as a fact checker. Now that makes me anxious just thinking about it. And I think you described that quite wonderfully in your book. He's published articles, essays, and reviews, and American Scholar, Atlantic, Granta, lots of other things.
He's also the author of Muses, Madmen, and Prophets: Hearing Voices and the Borders of Sanity. And you wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, correct?
As well,
Daniel?
Yes.
Yeah, this is when the Atlantic Monthly was still in Boston before they were torn from their birthplace and brought to Washington, D.C., something I still lament all these years later. But I did some writing for The Atlantic on the side, not as sort of part of my job there.
He also does a podcast with Liz Hines, and it's called the N+1 Podcast, and he's currently at the Critlow Endowed Chair in English at the College of New Rochelle. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us in the studio is Luana Marquez, who's a PhD and a clinical research fellow in psychology at the Mass General Hospital, Harvard Medical School. She's got a new book coming out in October called Almost Anxious.
And we're showing everybody the cover.
Is my or my loved one's worry or distress a problem? And she works at Mass General and specializes in anxiety. Treating anxiety. I specialize in anxiety.
How are you doing with that anxiety, Jen?
I need a drink.
So, Daniel.
Yes.
I want to say thank you for publishing this. I want to hand it to all my anxious patients and say, see, we get it. This is what you were talking about.
Daniel wrote an amazing and funny and poignant memoir about his anxiety. In the intro to the book, Daniel, you describe your daily anxiety-filled walks to your therapy sessions. Could you read that, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This was some years ago when I was working at The Atlantic, and my therapist was located in Charlestown, and once a week I would go there. My walks to therapy were spent outlining with great logical precision the manner in which my state of mind would lead me to complete existential ruin. A typical line of thought went something like this: I am anxious. The anxiety makes it impossible to concentrate. Because it is impossible to concentrate, I will make an unforgivable mistake at work. Because I will make an unforgivable mistake at work, I will be fired. Because I will be fired, I will not be able to pay my rent. Because I will not be able to pay my rent, I will be forced to have sex for money in an alley behind Fenway Park. Because I will be forced to have sex for money in an alley behind Fenway Park, I will contract HIV. Because I will contract HIV, I will develop full-blown AIDS. Because I will develop full-blown AIDS, I will die disgraced and alone. From free-form anxiety to death by prostitution in 8 short steps. Most weeks, I found that I could kill myself off before I'd crossed the bridge into Charlestown. This gave me half a mile to fully experience the ignominy of my downfall, to see my mother wailing like a Sicilian peasant over my lime-complected corpse, to see the rabbi eulogizing my unfulfilled promise, to hear the thump of dirt on unfinished pine, to accompany my two brothers as they rush home from graveside to pull the plastic wrap off the cold-cut platters and switch on the coffee urn. Meanwhile, mounting the hill to the clinic near horizontal against the angle of ascent, I would do my best to weep for cathartic purposes. These were pathetic attempts at weeping, the bleedy cries of someone who has wept himself dry, like an ape laughing. Sweaty with strain and agitation, I would try to manufacture bona fide tears, and always, always, I would fail. By the time I arrived at the clinic, I was typically so demoralized I could barely stand. I was 23 years old, and I looked like Nixon resigning the presidency.
I think that the thoughts that go through there is just such a beautiful, beautiful description of it.
Thank you so much. The sad, I think the part that's both funny and sad is that it's not an exaggeration.
It's not funny or sad, yes.
Yeah, well, then that's what makes it both funny and sad.
Yes.
So what's great about the show today is that we have a clinical professional sitting here in the studio who can put a different spin on that. Dr. Marcus, what did you think of what Daniel wrote there?
Well, I first want to thank Daniel for writing such a compelling book and really giving words to what a lot of my patients experience. It's a great description of the chain of thoughts that anxiety-driven thoughts can get you. It really exemplified the catastrophe that the mind does, and I bet with a lot of physical sensations of anxiety too. It's a great definition of anxiety if there was one.
Yeah, it's wonderful and compelling at the same time, because I think everybody can identify with going down that rabbit hole. Dr. Marcus, are there different types of anxiety other than what Daniel's describing here?
Absolutely. So Daniel, in that description, gave a good sense of sort of general anxiety thoughts. In our diagnostic system now, we have, if you think about anxiety as sort of one big, you know, system of sensations and thoughts, then you have different types. You have generalized anxiety disorder, which is sort of the monkey mind, right? It's worrying about worrying and not being able to stop your thoughts.
I like that. Worrying about worrying. Does that sound about right, Dan?
Yeah, that sounds pretty right. I mean, at the very least, anxiety has you worry about certain things, and then you start worrying about certain things. And as soon as that happens, you're on the merry-go-round, and it just becomes this kind of circle of anxious thoughts. Because Luana said something very important, and so did you, which is that it's not just a cerebral thing. It's an enormously physical sensation. It's an embodied sensation. Everybody has sort of their own particular brand of what it feels like to them. There are some commonalities, but it grasps you. It really does. And once it does, you become fearful that it's going to come back. And that's when the sort of circle of dread begins.
So, Dan, you were talking about getting on the merry-go-round, and then you start to really panic. Can you kind of describe that just a bit?
In my experience, there is a particular difference between an anxiety attack and a panic attack. For me, the way I think of it is that once you get on that being on that merry-go-round itself, once it starts to go very fast, is anxiety attack, a sort of mounting of that sensation so that it takes over and all but paralyzes your action, makes it impossible to think of other things, makes it very difficult to be productive, so that those thoughts are kind of ringing in your head very loudly and constantly. A panic attack is a bit different, and it's not something that I've had to struggle with all that much, luckily, because the few times that I've had it, it's both the kind of logical endpoint of an anxiety attack and also something quite different, because it's almost as if your sort of animal nature takes over, the
right.
fight or flight mechanism takes over, and you are way beyond anxiety to kind of full paralysis.
Right.
This is, as you can tell, this isn't a strict clinical definition of these things.
So, doctor, what do you think of his definition? No,
I think I agree with you completely, Daniel, that the anxiety of the mind and that thought getting stuck is very different than an experience of a panic attack itself, and that just having a panic attack does not mean somebody's going to develop a clinical condition called a panic disorder, for example, which is really that fear of having another panic attack, but that it's equally debilitating to have the experience of somebody else, meaning the anxiety running in your mind. And I think in your book you do a fantastic job explaining that and really laying the groundwork that millions of Americans suffer.
I'm interested in knowing more about the causes of anxiety. First of all, are you born with anxiety?
You're definitely not born with anxiety. You may have a genetic predisposition to have anxiety because it runs in your family. But I wouldn't say somebody's born with anxiety. That being said, we all have anxiety. So I'm talking about anxiety at the clinical level that interferes.
Right, the causes of that kind of anxiety.
So in that case, there's definitely some studies that show genetic transmission of anxiety, but there's also the role of the environment and how the environment can make you actually manifest anxiety symptoms.
And speaking of environments, if you're born into a family where there's a mother with high levels of anxiety like our author Daniel Smith.
And some other people we know.
And some other people we know. I grew up in a Jewish family, I'm not going to lie. Daniel, your mom is kind of plays really integrally into your story of anxiety. Could you read the interface with Esther?
I should maybe set up that
yep.
Esther was, when I met Esther when I was a teenager, and she was of legal majority, as they say. She was in her 20s, and I was about 16, and I lost my virginity to her in a situation that I found rather distressing, that other 16-year-old boys might have found cause for a ticker tape parade. I'll call her. So this is the beginning of the second chapter after the first chapter, which is not fit for radio.
Yes.
I'll call her Esther, the plump blonde with the penchant for teenage boys, the penchant for me. I met her while working at a bookstore in Plainview, New York, at the rough longitudinal and latitudinal center of Long Island, where I was born and raised. She took an instant liking to me, and then she took my virginity, and going on 2 decades later, my mind still hasn't recovered. Esther set my anxiety off. She was the match that lit the psychic fire. It all starts with Esther. Either that or it all starts with my mother. I can never decide. Losing my virginity in a way that even my most depraved friends find unfortunate had an immediate and profound impact on me. But my mother set up the circumstance whereby there could be a trigger like Esther, whereby it was only a matter of time until something set me off. In every important way, cognitive, behavioral, environmental, genetic, my mother laid the foundation of this intractable problem of mine.
Wow. That's that's really
well.
She's
a good sport, my mom.
I was just about to ask.
She read the manuscript. She okayed it. I wasn't gonna say anything unless she was okay with it. We have a good relationship.
You'd better.
Mm-hmm. Well, she comes off rather well in the
yeah,
end.
Yeah, she does.
Book.
No, she really does. She comes off loving and insightful
and supportive
and, you know, and anxious and, you know.
Well, yeah, more than just loving and supportive, I think the redemptive thing for her as a character in this book, which is not an easy thing for anyone to be a character in a book, is that she had suffered really monumentally from anxiety, in particular the panic disorder that Luana was talking about, and really went after the problem tooth and nail. She is now a psychotherapist who specializes in the anxiety disorders, and from what I understand, is a very effective and certainly a very compassionate one.
Luana, does this sound like a typical kind of dynamic petri dish to set up anxiety in somebody?
I don't think there's a typical dynamic, but certainly one that I hear over and over again. And what I really love about the story and how it plays out, and one that I really admire your mom for doing, Daniel, is the idea that she really approaches her anxiety instead of avoid it. And that's something I talk about in Almost Anxious a lot, and she does it beautifully, despite of how difficult it is. And so you can see that it can run in the family, the anxiety piece, but that it can change, and that, you know, in your case, you've also made meaning out of your anxiety and found ways to overcome it in a productive way.
So say that. I mean, I think what you were saying that before the show, the kind of the advice you gave Jill.
Mm-hmm. Our producer.
So you were saying approach it instead of avoid it.
So
why would that be? How does that work?
Anxiety is something that, you know, most people come to my office and say, I do not want to feel anxious. It feels bad when it's that high anxiety. But often, if you find a way to actually engage with anxiety in a way that's sort of gradual, right, what I call being comfortable and uncomfortable, then a natural process of the fight or flight comes down, and you learn that your worst outcome doesn't come out. And so approach, not avoid.
I love that. What are some of the symptoms, like classic symptoms of anxiety?
So they're definitely the cognitive, the thinking symptoms that Daniel really talked about really well, but also the physical symptoms, right?
Oh, he talks about them well, too.
Exactly.
Thank you, Daniel, for that.
He does.
You guys have to read this book. It's just amazing.
It really is great, and he absolutely right. He also talked about the physical sensations. So things like heart pounding, sweaty, dizziness, feeling nauseous, feeling like you're paralyzed at the ultimate level. Those are all very common symptoms of anxiety.
Daniel, what were the things that you found most debilitating of you? I mean, not most, but what are the things you kind of spent the most time with as far as physical symptoms?
Well, when I said everyone has their own particular thing, that was because I recognized early on that whenever I had a kind of flush of anxiety, for me it manifested itself as what I call the kind of icicle in my chest. And it was this sense of not just a tension, but a kind of coldness, a kind of sharpness on the inside of my sternum. That was my own idiosyncratic reaction. I think that part of the body, though, the kind of solar plexus, the chest, the stomach in particular, is very susceptible to a kind of being signaled by that anxiety, or being the anxiety signal itself. But on top of that, there was the dreaded sweating that comes with anxiety, which has its own kind of pattern, like we were talking about with the thinking, in that you start to sweat because of the anxiety. It causes you to perspire. And then, of course, if you're working at an office, like I was working at the Atlantic, you start to worry that people are going to notice the sweating, which makes you more anxious, which makes you sweat more, and so on and so forth until, you know, it's 20 degrees outside and you're sweating through your shirt and feeling rather foolish about it. So there was that. There was certainly nausea and sort of tension, headaches, tingling in the limbs, all sorts of.
That sounds horrible.
You know, I don't mean to make you anxious, but you know, there's a lot of physical reactions that come with the anxiety sensation.
Dan, you have this wonderful thing on page 84 where you talk about the kind of. It's the first time, I think, in the book at that point that you've kind of come to peace with the big picture. Do you mind reading that on page 84?
Time is just a distraction to anxiety. Its power to comfort is tied directly to its ability to maintain consistency. So long as the days are the same, so long as the ride is generally smooth, you've got a halfway decent chance of remaining steady. If you are a desert hermit or a cloistered nun, this approach may hold anxiety at bay for a lifetime. If you are a regular person with regular human relationships, if you exist in the flux of mundane reality, you're sleepwalking toward the edge of a cliff.
I think that, you know, that
now we're entering the serious part of
right.
the program.
Right, but you're also entering the part where you're starting to, it felt like the first part of the book, your brain was jumping around and you were in there with it. And this felt like the beginning of kind of trying to come to terms with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, before that time, I had been a kind of nervous kid, but not in a way that bespoke any mental disorder or that was really serious. I had phobias and so on as a kid. Lots of kids do. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I was 16 or so that the anxiety flourished. And I didn't do anything about it, and it kind of calmed down on its own, which can happen sometimes with anxiety. But for me in particular, who I think there is some genetic component to my anxiety, I think I'm kind of primed to it. My mind works that way. It was going to come back. And when it did, you know, it was like, you know, fool me once. I don't remember how George Bush mangled that phrase. I was going to try to do that. But, you know, the second time around, you have no choice but to contend with it.
Yes.
And that's what happened.
How did you know to get help, Daniel?
I knew that I needed to get help because I was paralyzed by anxiety. I went away to college. I went to Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. And the anxiety came back, and it came back with such a vengeance that it was making it hard for me to enjoy life. Certainly impossible to get out of my own head. I would wake up anxious. I would go to sleep not anxious, but only because the anxiety had so fatigued me that by the end of the day I would pass out. I would have anxious dreams, and I would wake up anxious again. Now, I didn't necessarily go for help until my mother and father came to visit me in school and said, Daniel, you really need to do something about this. This is becoming a problem for you. I'm sure I would have found that, you know, gone down that path myself
right.
in time. But I was told that very, you know, with great energy and force that I should do that.
So when you look back on this, and that, I mean, besides writing the memoir, you've obviously been with this a while. How did you get better? We want people to know that people can get better, and you're obviously much better. How did you do that?
I am. I mean, you know, it is important to say that anxiety is not just a mental condition, that it is a universally felt emotion. So yes, of course, sometimes it inflates to that point where it becomes, you know, on the pathological spectrum. I no longer descend into those states where I'm paralyzed by the anxiety. And for me, two things have been enormously helpful. One of them was finding that therapist who I would visit in Charlestown. He was the first person who really gave me some tools to mitigate the anxiety. And I didn't really discover till later that he was a pretty strict cognitive therapist, which means that the theory that he worked under was that every time I felt a kind of wash of anxiety come over me, I had said something to myself. We're always talking to ourselves. And I was saying certain things to myself and articulating certain beliefs in my own head that if I could understand them, if I could listen to them, if I could be mindful of them, then I could actually challenge those thoughts and those beliefs, thoughts that, like the ones that I read earlier on. The possibility, for example, of a junior editor at the Atlantic Monthly ending up prostituting himself behind an alley behind Fenway Park.
A well-educated
Park.
One, too.
Yeah. It's, yeah, yeah. I mean, as someone once said to me, don't you think, or I think as Brian said, my therapist, don't you think your mom would take you in or your brothers would lend you some money if it came down to it? I was, you know, I had come from enough privilege that it's unlikely that's going to happen. And Brian, that therapist, was the first one who really encouraged me to be mindful of those thoughts. The other thing that's helped is practicing some degree of mindfulness meditation, some Zen Buddhism in particular, which is different in the second order in that it tells you to let go instead of examining those thoughts. But it does, the first ingredient, the primary ingredient, is mindfulness, being
right.
aware of what enters your mind.
And so Dr. Marcus is in the studio nodding her head up and down. I think she wants to speak on this.
Absolutely. I love the message, Daniel, and I think it's so consistent with what evidence shows, and the fact that I agree that you have to do both. So especially when your mind is running amok, the ability to be mindful to your thoughts and understanding it, because you're absolutely right, anxiety is a normal phenomenon. And eventually you'll get to that level again that feels like a little too much, and using those tools like mindfulness can help it. You capitalize on your anxiety, but I also like the idea that you use some cognitive approaches, which are also evidence-based, and help you change the way you're talking to yourself so you can be mindful of it, but only also use an approach that is more active so the tools can be there when you get into trouble again, if you ever.
Daniel, you know, we were discussing how a lot of people turn towards drugs and alcohol. Did you self-medicate with substances at all?
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I still do. I don't have an addictive personality. My anxiety makes me so terrified of becoming addicted to anything that I never go down that path. And I also just don't think that it's in me in terms of my mind, my nervous system. But drugs, alcohol, in particular alcohol and marijuana, these things are forebears hundreds of thousands of years ago first distilled grains because it calmed them down. I mean, it's a wonderful, it's very effective. And when you're young and stupid, you don't realize that it'll simply exacerbate the anxiety, that all you're doing is putting a Band-Aid on it for that moment. You're not doing anything to foster better habits of mind or better habits of thought, better habits of behavior. You're simply masking the anxiety. And as you get older, you also realize that that alcohol is a kind of anxiety boomerang.
Yeah.
You know, you get over 30 years old, and you instead of having a few drinks and then sleeping for 12 hours, you have a few drinks and you wake up at 3 in the morning in a panic.
Yep, you do.
And human beings are not as intelligent as we give ourselves credit for, so we keep doing those things. And, you know, sometimes I still in a state of some agitation or exhaustion or stress.
Right.
Instead of doing the things that I know cultivate a sort of sustainable habits of mind, pour a drink.
This is pointing towards treatment. Like, how do, Dr. Marcus, how do people treat anxiety?
So I'm very biased here because I am a cognitive behavioral therapist, although I really practice a lot of mindfulness as well. So you really want to teach a few things. One, I tell my patients the first thing is to really regulate their system. So sleep, eating, exercise, right? It's sort of, we're like a car. We can't get much further if we don't have gas and batteries and some tires, right?
Right.
Then the next thing is changing your thinking. Having more adaptive thoughts based in reality, really challenging some of that. And then the third one is what I've said before again and again. You have to approach, not avoid. And you have to do that despite of the anxiety. The anxiety tells you a story of paralyzing and not approaching things, but that keeps you at home and you more panic, like Daniel talked about. The more anxious you have, the more worries you have, you get on this fear cycle, and you really don't get better. So you have to change your dance.
Well, I think there's another piece, and I'm going to sound like the person I am, but there's also the part where you have to figure out what the cause is. Anxiety is so often a symptom of, if you know, going into details about your early childhood, like in Dan's case, didn't fix it, but in some ways you really, it helps to know what caused it, or if there's a depression, or if there's you know, other things that are looking like an anxiety disorder.
Absolutely.
What about meds, medication? We've talked about self-medication. Are there medications that you use to treat anxiety?
So I can't prescribe, given that I'm a clinical psychologist, but you know, I know my colleagues who prescribe some of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Zoloft. And of course, there are medication for anxiety like the benzodiazepines, Valium, Xanax.
We spend a lot of time getting people off of.
Exactly. So my preference, the clinical psychologist should keep people off of them and really teach them to find the causes of the anxiety and stay off those meds in particular.
So CBT, mindfulness.
Therapy,
approach, not avoid. And by the way, Daniel, you need to be a little more thankful to anxiety because you've got a pretty good career due to your suffering.
Well, yeah. I you know, like to think that I would have found a different subject. You know, I write better when I'm not anxious.
Yeah,
I
that's
don't. You know, it's true that anxiety is valuable and motivating as an emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, if you define anxiety as a kind of state of nervous vigilance, it was necessary, you know, as a species, we need this in order to survive.
One of the things we wanted to talk to you about, Dan, was you were talking about the idea of maintenance, how you try to stay on track and not get overwhelmed by your anxiety anymore. And you talked about it to do with relapse. Do you want to talk about that a little?
You know, the way I think of anxiety is, at least at this point in my life, years into it, the experience of anxiety is that it feels like a habit. It feels like, you know, there are certain patterns of thought that are just going to be the patterns that I slip into if I'm not careful, if I'm not vigilant. And it is being mindful of it. I think Luana's right to say to approach the anxiety, to walk into it, because the more you try to kind of ward it away, ward those thoughts away, the stronger that they get. But anxiety, these anxious thoughts are usually so overwrought, not impossible, you know, what they say could happen, but overwrought, and their idea of threat is overinflated that being aware of that and trying to cultivate better habits of mind, better ways, better patterns every day, if you're the type of person like me who is going to be anxious otherwise, is the only way, I think. Mm-hmm. So habit is something I really think a great deal about.
Luana, when you work with a patient, what's the typical length of treatment for somebody that's suffering from this?
So I see people short term, and usually when they're in a stage, they really want to approach their anxiety. So I see people from 12 to 20 sessions, and then we sort of phase out and do it biweekly or every month. And I then focus on a lot on what Daniel was talking about. I think about anxiety and sort of a cognitive behavior approach, like going to the gym. If you go to the gym once a month, that's sort of what you get. And if you don't, you know, if you're actually going more often and you're paying attention to your thoughts, then you're less likely to be anxious, or at least to not have that anxiety at that level that really debilitates you.
So for folks who don't really know, can you explain just really quickly what cognitive behavioral therapy is and how that works into anxiety treatment?
Absolutely. So it's an evidence-based, meaning there's lots of research behind it, and generally is to look at your thoughts, like Daniel has talked about, and in particular the anxiety-driven thoughts, and try to find the reality base for those thoughts or the evidence behind them. And then the behavioral piece is to really change the way you relate to that anxiety and try to do things that would allow you to approach the anxiety instead of avoid it, despite of having that anxiety there.
So exposure to something. If you're afraid of spiders, sitting in a room with spiders every day and progressively getting closer to them will help with your fear of spiders.
Absolutely. And there are different approaches, right? There's flooding that people did before. And nowadays, we tend to do a little more gradual. So you're going to be in a room far away from the spire and try to approach it as much as you can up to the point that you're actually touching the spire.
So you're not going to end up, like, you know, loving spiders so much. They're going to be, you're happy to have pets and all that. But the idea is to make it so it's, you can live a normal life without this kind of irrational anxiety.
Absolutely. So that you can really be in a place that the spider phobia is not running your life.
So one of the things that Dan talks about in his book, and Dan, you'll have to answer this too, is relationships and how there was a point where you were you were in a relationship with somebody wonderful and it didn't work. And then we'll use recovery. You know, you recovered, or you got into recovery and started working your program. And that sounds so jargony, but you were able to be in relationship. So what is the relationship between, having a relationship and your recovery?
Well, for me, it was remember, you know, when you're anxious, you're in a state of alarm. You're in a state of, it feels as if you're being threatened. And when a human being is being threatened and feels in that state of alarm, you look for what's causing it. Very often, the person who's in front of you is the person that you blame and the person who you consider to be part of the cause of your anxiety, and you want to escape from that. You want to escape from whatever you're in. In addition, there's some shame that goes along with anxiety very often. Mm-hmm. So you don't want this person who you adore and want to think well of you to see you as weak, which is how you often think of yourself. So of utmost importance, I think, is to recognize that it is not a weakness that you're experiencing, and that the person that you're with is not the cause of your anxiety, usually. Once you can do that, you start to build something, at least in my experience, of a firewall between yourself and between and your love for this person, so that the anxiety, even if you still feel it, doesn't infect that person. Now you can go further and cultivate better habits and you know, go into therapy and learn to mitigate your anxiety so that you can actually see the other person, because anxiety can really make it hard to love another human being because you're so stuck in your own head.
I really want to thank Daniel Smith, author of Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. It's a New York Times bestseller.
You know, I think if anybody has anybody in their life with anxiety, I mean, it was a fun read, too.
Yeah.
But it really got you to understand, you know, all those little, oh, don't worry about it, it's no big deal, isn't going to affect that.
Right, and taking it down to the personal level, it's easier to identify with and kind of easier to go towards. So thank you so much, Daniel, for being our guest today. Also, thank you, Dr. Luana Marjas, whose new book, Almost Anxious, Is My or My Loved One's Worry or Distress a Problem, is coming out in October. She is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much, Dr. Marjas. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.